Well, there were about 12 graduates in chemical engineering in the class of 1922. Because of his influence, largely, seven of them went on to get graduate work. I think perhaps six of them got PhD degrees.
Did they go into chemistry as well, or into chemical engineering?
They were all in chemistry, yes. Well, one of them, I think, got a master's degree at Harvard, perhaps in metallurgy, and got a job with an iron and steel company. And so perhaps he was more of a metallurgical engineer, I'm not sure. I think I saw him once later on in Pittsburgh, many years later. Paul Emmett was one of them. And Alf Robertson had a National Research Council fellowship after getting his PhD at Wisconsin. He worked most of his life for Eastman Kodak and in industrial chemistry. I don't know what he was doing in the photographic business. Bill Tooley got a PhD at Illinois and worked for, I think, her rubber company, or a chemical company, in Stamford, Connecticut, whatever company that is. Oz Helmer worked on medicinal chemistry after getting his PhD. He worked for Eli Lilly and company. And I think there may have been one or two others. Well, chemical engineers were probably the smartest people at Oregon Agricultural College.
That's a remarkable record for 1922, to have that many.
To have 7 out of 12 get PhDs, chemical engineers from a small Cal College get PhDs in chemistry. When I gave some lectures at Berkeley about 4 years ago, three members, these are general university lectures, three members of the chemistry department came up to me to tell the same story, which I'd never heard. And I think it's apocryphal. Mm-hmm. See, I didn't get a reply to my application to Berkeley. Harvard offered me a half-time instructorship and said it would take 6 years to get a PhD. Mm-hmm. So I turned it down.
Was that from Richards? Did he write to you at that time?
No. Editor of JCS,
Arthur Lamb.
Arthur B. Lamb wrote to me. He was director of the chemical laboratories, professor and director of the chemical laboratories. I turned that down, and Norris said that I should reply immediately, pretty soon, in a few years, didn't take very long, there was so much complaint about that sort of action, the universities decided, or the chemistry departments decided, that they should say, this offer is open until the 1st of April, so that they could all have a chance. Well, I accepted and wrote to Berkeley saying that I'd accepted the appointment. Well, the story is that G.N. Lewis was looking over the applications in the spring of 1922, and there weren't very many, perhaps 25. The departments were small, as I pointed out in my talk today. So he came to one and looked at it, the story goes, and said, Linus Pauling, Oregon Agricultural College, I've never heard of that place, and down it went in the discard pile.
The interesting to know. But it does sound apocryphal.
I think it's apocryphal. Yeah. Here, I've been around Berkeley for 50 years before I heard that story. So I'd surely have heard it earlier on.
Yeah. What did Illinois say? Did you go through with that application, or did you just withdraw it?
I think I hadn't heard from them when I accepted the CIT offer. Well, Noyes was pretty clever, I think, to pick Paul Emmett and me from Oregon Agricultural College to offer fellowships to.
Of course, it's interesting, had you gone to Illinois at that time, that Arnold Beckman was there.
Well, he came. He was 2 years later, I think. He got his PhD at CIT in 1927, I think. Or came in 1924. I had come in 1922. But we were fraternity brothers, in that he was in Delta Upsilon fraternity at Illinois, and I was in Delta Upsilon fraternity in Oregon State, one of the founding members of the chapter. I said to him last year, I think, that I had decided that his spectrophotometer was named DU because of his being a member of the DU fraternity. And he said, no, that wasn't so, that DU meant something, and I don't remember now what
it was. It was the fourth prototype model, and
yes.
Ultraviolet. So D,
yes.
Ultraviolet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah. Of course, it's certainly a reasonable assumption that it was for Delta Upsilon. I wanted to ask you a little later about some Arnold Beckman connections, but incidentally, he had a very similar introduction to chemistry. He had a high school teacher who had him do analyses on the side of similar kinds of industrial applications, and he took a course in metallography while he was still in high school, and then went on to study in Illinois. It's very interesting how you in Oregon and he in Illinois had similar backgrounds at the time in chemistry. Caltech must have been a very different environment from the Oregon Agricultural College in Corvallis.
Yes, indeed.
You mentioned in one of your autobiographical articles working the problems in Noyes and Sherrill over the summer and reading the Bragg's book on X-rays and crystal structure. Did that help bring you up to speed for when you got to Pasadena in the fall?
Well, I suppose so. I don't remember very clearly. It didn't take me very long to learn that within 3 months I had been taught the technique of determining the structure of crystals as it had been developed up to that time. It took 3 months. In fact, November, I had studied 14 crystals by about the 1st of November or 15th of November, which I had made in the laboratory. I looked up cubic crystals, since Roscoe had told me that, Roscoe Dickinson, that the cubic crystals were the ones that could be analyzed, or hexagonal crystals, or tetragonal, but mainly cubic. So I hunted through the crystallographic literature, Grote's Chemische Crystallographie, 5 volumes, and page by page, looking for cubic crystals. And one that I made was CaHgBr4. Each of these, as I made it, I subjected to preliminary X-ray examination to determine the size of the unit and the number of atoms in the unit cell. And CHGBr4 turned out to contain 32 calcium atoms, 32 mercury atoms, and 128 bromine atoms. This was just an impossible problem. And another one, I dehydrated nickel sulfate, hexahydrate, to get nickel sulfate, and mixed it with potassium sulfate. I built a furnace, an electric furnace, and melted them together and let them melt cool slowly and got crystals of K2Ni2SO4 three times, and determined the unit cell and space group for it. And I found that the structure depended on 19 parameters. Dickinson was working on a structure that depended on 5 parameters, and he succeeded. But most structures were 0 or 1 or 2 parameters.
In those 19 days. Would have been biting off a little more 19, than anyone could chew.
Yes. The structure was determined later, 25 years later, by somebody. So then I made the Mg2SN by melting magnesium and tin together and letting it cool slowly. And it was brittle, so I just broke the pellet, inch diameter about, with a hammer, and got fragments, cleavage fragments, just well suited to X-ray study. And I melted sodium and dissolved cadmium in it, let it cool slowly, put the product into absolute ethanol, which dissolves the sodium and doesn't attack sodium dicadmide, and got very nice octahedra of sodium dicadmide. The Mg2SN, of course, I determined a no-parameter structure, the first intermetallic compound reported in the literature to have its structure determined. And NaCD2 I mentioned in the same paper, but not in the title, as having very large unit of structure, at least 1,000 atoms in the unit cube. Roscoe then got some samples of molybdenite from the stockroom, just molybdenum disulfide, water-worn pebbles, but they were single crystals. You could cleave these pebbles and get cleavage sheets, which gave good X-ray photographs. So that was the first paper.
Yeah. And you wrote in that AVOL volume on 50 years of X-ray diffraction that, looking back on it, that you still found that a pleasing structure, having, you know, finding this surprising result that it was a trigonal prism, rather than
yes,
the structure that people expected.
Yes. Well, it was a lot of fun, X-ray crystallography. I began attacking more difficult problems by this stochastic method. I was getting to the point where, by 1927, I guess, after I got back from Europe, I had enough knowledge about, perhaps sort of vague sometimes, about principles of structure of crystals so that I could say ahead of time what I thought the structure would be. And then I could check the proposed structure by the X-ray diffraction pattern. And if it agreed, I would say this is the structure. And of course, it could even be refined to give better agreement, although that wasn't done very much because it involved too much calculation. Or I could build a model and measure the model. That's what we did with Brookite with one of my first graduate students, James Sturtevant. I remember going for an automobile ride, how I happened, near the Institute, just at the corner of Hill and San Pasquale streets. Roscoe said that he thought it was fine that I was doing these structures that I was doing, but it was something that he could never do. He taught me, I've mentioned this several times in interviews, he taught me to be rigorous, to know at every stage and whatever I was working on, whatever I was thinking about, what conclusions I had reached that could be supported rigorously, what conclusions involved an assumption somewhere along the line. So I was fortunate, and of course I was fortunate to have Tolman teaching there. He was enthusiastic about teaching science. He gave a course my first semester, I think, on principles of physical science. Not like any other course that I've ever heard about, where he discussed dimensional analysis, for example. And he even brought in the principle of relativity of size, which is something that he had formulated. He had asked, what restraints are there on physics, our understanding of the physical world, if we make the assumption that the dimensional scale of the universe could be changed a millionfold, say, and without changing the nature of physics, without changing the values of the dimensionless physical constants, such as the fine structure constant or others. And he tried to draw conclusions from that. He wasn't successful enough for it to have remained part of physics.
Well, it's interesting, though, that kind of speculation and abstract intellectual activity was going on at Caltech. I mean, wow.
Yes. And then we had a course that Tolman gave on, perhaps even that first year, there was a course that Tolman gave on atomic and molecular physics, old quantum theory, using a book called The Origin of Spectra by Foote and Moeller. Very good book. I learned a lot of basic physics, quantum physics, from it. Then the next year, Tolman gave a course on Atombaum Spektrallinien using Sommerfeld's book in German. It hadn't been translated. Also, I think a freshman the first year. Well, the first quarter, Noyce gave a course on chemical thermodynamics, the last four chapters of Noyce and Sherrill, which I took. It was the last course that A. Noyce taught. He didn't ever teach another course. Very soon, and I don't remember when, but I think the second semester of my freshman year, there was a course on chemical thermodynamics using Lewis and Randall. So if Lewis and Randall came out in time, it was that year. If not, it may have been the following year. But my memory is that I, and I'm not sure about this, that I had a copy of Lewis and Randall along when I went to Oregon to be married in 1923. Hmm. That may not be true. Then the following year, 1924, Tolman gave another course on atomic and molecular, well, atomic physics, using the English edition, line atomic structure and spectral lines, which had come out in English translation. So you could see how much emphasis there was on modern quantum science in the chemistry department, to say nothing of the physics department. Yeah.
What kind of mathematics were you taking at that time? Because I noticed in your first few papers already you were very familiar with group theory, and you know, we're using all of space group analysis that Wyckoff had come up with.
Oh yes, well, the space group theory Dickinson taught me. That was hardly anything that I had done. That became routine to use group theory. The selection rules for space groups had not been tabulated yet, so I had to tabulate these rules myself for the space groups that I was interested in. The first year, you know, if I make statements, my biographer, Bob Paradowski, is that to say that documents show that what I said isn't right? He has all of this stuff.
Yeah, I'd like to get in touch with him at some point.
Yeah. The first year, I think I had a course in Whittaker in advanced algebra, using a book, Gursa Hedrick. And along my first graduate year, possibly second, but I think even in the first, Harry Bateman, a great mathematician, gave a course in vector analysis. And that was one of the most valuable courses I've ever had, the vector analysis. Later, I studied mathematical analysis using Whittaker and Watson modern analysis, which is pretty advanced classical mathematics. And I had a course in integral equations from E.T. Bell. I think from E.T. Bell, integral equations, possibly Harry Bateman. I had a very valuable course on the Newtonian potential theory given by Harry Bateman. So very rapidly, I built up a pretty good mathematical background.
I wonder if you could, you've talked about Dickinson and about some of Tolman's courses. Noyes gave his last course then. Could you just talk a little bit about personal interactions with the faculty and your fellow graduate students in those first couple of years at Caltech?
Well, the first year I wasn't married. I lived with Paul Emmett and his mother. His mother had come down to take care of Paul. He was a sort of mother's boy. And I lived with them. Paul and I went to some of the same courses. Dickinson and his wife took me to the desert a couple of times. They liked going out to the Colorado desert the Palm Springs area, mm-hmm. or Painted Canyon, about 50 miles beyond Palm Springs on the other side of the Coachella Valley. And so that was nice. A couple of times, perhaps only once, I went with Paul and his mother and I don't know who else on an automobile ride about 50 miles or more down toward Orange County through the orange groves and back with one graduate student, the fellow who was standing up with the mm-hmm. faculty there. I went on a hiking trip up Mount Wilson area, and we got lost in the wilderness there, and wandered around, no trails. Finally ended up at Opid's camp after crawling through brush. This taught me a lesson about just following along with someone else. Mm-hmm. In fact, he crawled out on a cliff, and I crawled out on this cliff too, and then I realized this was a foolhardy thing to do. It was loose rock, not hard rock climbing, and here he came from the east, from Yale. He didn't know anything about the mountains. He might well have killed both of us. So I stopped and sort of froze and said, "We have to go back." And with his encouragement, I gradually worked my way back. There was a big drop of 500 feet, perhaps, from this mountain. And he came back too. But he might have killed himself. In fact, I guess he did kill himself some years later in an explosion in his laboratory. Yeah. I can still remember how frightened I was when I realized what was going on.
I can imagine.
So we were stuck up there, hiking our way out, and nightfall was approaching. And I remembered that a fraternity brother of mine lived up the canyon. And we managed to find her, the fraternity brother's mother, who put us up for the night and sent us on our way the next morning. There was a bus. We had got into a canyon up the Arroyo Seco, where there was a bus line that came. So that was about the extent of my social contacts during my freshman year. I wrote a letter to my future wife every night and got a letter from her every day. And I'd work in the laboratory until about 11 o'clock, perhaps, and then come home and go to bed. Paul had delivered the morning paper in Portland and had to get up at 4 o'clock. He was in the habit of getting up at 4 o'clock. So even at that, we had contact at all three meals that we had in his mother's home there. But didn't have very much contact. After I got married, of course, then we had a lot of contact with faculty members and with other students. Bob Robertson, Howard Percy Robertson, had come down my second year, I think he had arrived, from Washington, where he had been studying mathematics with E.T. Bell. E.T. Bell arrived to be professor of mathematics. And Bob Robertson and I and his wife and my wife were together quite a lot then. He's the Robertson who had a student named Walker so that there is the Robertson-Walker universe. He became a cosmologist.
Yeah. Excuse me a second.